right from the beginning of running ultras, I had that trust. You have to let go, because an ultra, it's such a great metaphor for life, but there's so many variables and so many factors you can't predict. You know, in one race, it's not like road running where, you know, the same distance is the same race. You know, if you run a marathon in this city, it's the same in that one. You know, there's terrain, there's elevation, there's weather, there's, you know, the technical trails. And so you really have to let go of any preconceived notion and sort of open to what will be.
Okay, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, by trade and training, a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. And as this is our first episode of 2020, just a quick thank you for reconnecting and reinvesting back into you being the best version of you. And that's actually why Coach Carroll, the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, he and I founded and pulled together Compete to Create. And it's really the methodology, is the science, the training of your mind so that you can work towards being your very best. And certainly Finding Mastery is part of that mechanism. And, you know, we get to have conversations with some of the most extraordinary humans on the planet, those that are dedicating their life efforts towards understanding mastery of self. And they definitely have mastery of craft, but what we're interested in is how have they become the human that they've become, not necessarily what they've done, but both are equally compelling. And the way that we're going to do that is by understanding their psychological framework, which is a fancy phrase for how do they make sense of the world around them, events, how do they fit in the world, what is their purpose, how are they aligning their thoughts, their words, their actions across any circumstance or environment. And then we're going to double click under that to understand the mental skills that they use to build and refine their craft. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing. It just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product, and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's hims, hims.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. And now this week's conversation is with Katie Arnold. She's a longtime journalist and elite ultra runner. And Katie was the 2018 Leadville Trail 100 Run Champion. And for those of you who understand elite running and ultra, this is a massive accomplishment. And if you're not familiar with the Leadville, it's an ultra marathon held annually on the rugged trails and dirt roads near Leadville, Colorado. And it's through the heart of the Rocky Mountains. But what makes this course, this ultra event, incredibly difficult is the elevation. So there's a climb and a descend of 15,600 feet, which those elevations that they've got in there range from 9,000 to 12,000 feet, somewhere in there, which it makes it incredibly difficult. It's like you're running on goat trails up at, you know, towards 12,000 feet. So it's really challenging on the body and subsequently the mind. And so Katie has deep understanding about how she's done that, but this conversation is not about checking the box running. I'm not a runner. That's not what I do. And that's not what I'm fascinated here. But Katie is incredibly thoughtful. She's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine, and she's written for so many well-respected publications, you know, the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Runner's World, ESPN, the magazine, Elle, lots of others. And she recently published a new book called Running Home, a memoir. And while running is the through line in her book, this conversation is about much more than running. And we discuss resilience and grief and why and how we're so much stronger than we might think. And running is just Katie's way through those things, the difficult times, the challenges. And anytime she references running, I think you could scratch that out and include your thing, whatever your thing. It could be parenting, it could be business, it could be yodeling. I mean, whatever it is. And I think the message is the same. And that's what one of the reasons I'm so fascinated with this community that we're building is that we're not just looking at a person and saying, oh, well, she's a runner. I want to be a better runner, which is cool. But it's like, what has this extraordinary human done? And then double click underneath of that, how has she organized her inner life? And so this conversation definitely hit home for me. I'm not a runner, but it's really about understanding your path and, you know, getting the sights clearer on where you're heading next. And one other thing, if you love this podcast as much as I do, there's a couple things you can do to help. One is to tell two friends about Finding Mastery and show them how and where they can listen. Maybe they're new to the podcast, maybe they're not, but really help them through that process. And the other is to support our sponsors. And it's pretty mechanical. We don't get paid for per click or anything like that, but we benefit when they understand that this is a community that's strong and a community that takes actions towards best self. And so let our sponsors know that you found them using all the codes, the Finding Mastery, all that good stuff. So with that, I'm so excited to introduce Katie Arnold to you. Let's jump right into this conversation with her. Katie, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you doing, Michael?
Yeah. Congratulations on your body of work and what you've done. And, you know, there's not many people who have occupied the space that you occupy. And so I really want to understand your path, your framework, and the mental skills that you've used to be able to experience what you've experienced. So, you know, if we could just start out in like a very general question, is like, what was it about your upbringing that led you to this path?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there are several factors that kind of led me both into running and a physical life outside of adventure, but also writing. The two have always gone hand in hand for me. And I think first and foremost, the influence of my father in my life. He was a National Geographic photographer for his whole career back when Nat Geo photographers actually had an office, you know, at the headquarters in Washington, and would be sent out on these sort of exotic assignments. So he really taught me how to see the world as a photographer does, which is to pay attention and to be an observer of those moments that happen in all of our days that sometimes slip by without noticing. And my dad was an expert at noticing, because that's what photographers do, right? They've got their camera ready and they see that moment that some of us miss that can be beautiful or ordinary. But he knew how to capture it. And so growing up as his daughter, I became aware of the powers of observation. And that really fed me as a writer. From a young age, I knew I wanted to be a writer. His medium was photographs and mine was words, but the process is the same. And so his influence on me was huge in that area, just teaching me how to be awake in the world and pay attention. And then his other great influence on me was just loving being outside and being out in nature. And he was not an athlete. I mean, he was an adventurer, an explorer, but he wasn't out to push times or to win anything. But we just spent a lot of time outside, rambling around the woods, bashing through bushes, you know, sort of with sometimes without a destination. But I think that ultimately fed me in the way of not everything had to have a result or goal oriented. It was more about being in the experience. And then finally, I'll just say my parents divorced. So my parents, you know, separated when I was very young and I didn't live with my father. But kind of divorce at that time was so different. And kids, you know, we really didn't know anything what was happening. And I think as a result, that sort of helped me become a storyteller, right? When you're not sure what's going on in your life and no one's really telling you anything, you start to make up stories and try to solve the mystery of your life and what's happening to you. And, you know, I already had an imagination as a young writer, but kind of given the task of trying to solve the mystery of my life, I think really helped me as a writer, you know, to sort of go down that path of trying to figure things out. And so I think those are the, you know, the biggest factors in who I am now.
Okay. So let me work backwards. And super concretely, like, what age did your parents divorce?
My parents divorced officially when I was 5, but they separated when I was 2. So I don't have a memory of my father living at home with us.
Okay. And then you would forage in, you know, like just kind of bash around. I can't remember the word you used in like, what age comes to mind when you were thinking of that story?
Oh my gosh. We were always out walking, you know, from a very young age, probably 3 or 4, we just spent a lot of time outside. And my dad and the woman who would become my stepmother bought a farm in Virginia, I think when I was 6. And that is when we really started just going out on these rambles and dirt roads and kind of walking around the fields. From a very early age. And I will say too that, you know, being a child of divorce and then remarriage, both my parents remarried and I got some new siblings on my mother's side. And you know, it's hard to navigate that as a child. And so my safe place, or the place I went when I, you know, didn't know how to handle these complexities, was outside. You know, that was where I felt free and myself. And so from a very young age, I've always felt most at home outside.
Okay. I see how all of this informs writing and running.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So, okay. But I want to double click on two parts. Like, I want to understand how your dad taught you to observe. Mm-hmm. And it could be as simple as, like, you just watched him do it. But
yeah.
I really want to double click there. And I would also want to pull on, like, this idea of, what were the heavy emotions? What were the emotions that were difficult? And then how did you, I understand you just went outside, but, like, how did you that shape your narrative? And what did you struggle with at a young age through the mm-hmm. divorce process, which really the divorce is an emblem for an uprooting,
right?
You know, like a disruption in what the plan is.
And yeah, destabilization, right?
Yeah.
Where it just knocked off your stable platform.
Yeah. And so, okay, those two questions, but hold on, let me say this to you as well, is that I grew up in Virginia.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, dirt roads, in a farm, no streetlights, nearest neighbors, like quarter mile away, you know, that type of stuff. And I feel like it was so informative to grabbing some roots because the Mother Nature's swift and harsh and, you know, like we had to sort it out. And so I think we have at least some assumed shared experiences from that. So
that's great. What part of Virginia?
Yeah, it was a small town at the time called Warrenton.
And oh my gosh, that's really close to where my dad's farm is.
Yeah, how about it? And so
that's crazy.
Yeah. So I bet.
Yeah, the next county over in Rappahannock County.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay, good. What do you know? Okay. All right. So let's get into those two questions. Like, how did your dad teach it? And then how did you really sort out, besides just going outside, like how did you internally work out the disruptions?
Those are great questions. I think my dad really taught me. I just learned by watching. My dad had this great personality where he never was the one who was like, let me tell you how to do it, or let me be in your face about it. It was like, he had this quiet, sort of unassuming manner, and photography suited him so well because he was never the guy in front of the camera, right? He was the guy behind the lens. And so he could kind of disappear in a situation, as great photographers do, and kind of become his camera. And so my father was never the one to give me advice about how to be an observer, or here's how you do this, Katie, in five easy steps. You know, I just watched him, and he embodied his work and his way of being in the world so completely that it was like there was no gap between who he was and what he did. And so as a young observer, I couldn't articulate then at the time, but as a child, I just watched him, and he always had cameras dangling around his neck. You know, he had that mesh photographer's vest that we always teased him about, and he always had cameras, and he was always taking pictures, you know, and he did amazing work for National Geographic. And then of course he photographed our lives with him, you know, constantly. It was like he was trying to document everything. He seems a little bit ahead of his time, you know.
Two things struck me when you said he was, what he did and what he was were merged.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, wow. And then where I was going and while you were sharing was, I wonder if you mattered. Like, did you matter to him? Did the family matter to him? Because he was so absorbed in, let's say, capturing other, whether it was, you know, something in nature, and other meaning something in another country. And then you said, no. You just kind of got there. You're like, and he documented our family. So you were the subject of his attention as well.
You know, I wrestled with that. Did we matter? We lived far away. I lived full time with my mother in New Jersey in the suburbs of New York City. And I didn't spend that much time with my father. You know, when I did the math, when I was writing the book, it really didn't add up to that much time. You know, several weeks, maybe like a month a year. But when we were with him, he was all in. Like, he was hyper present to wherever he was. So if he was on assignment, you know, in Alaska, he was on assignment in Alaska. He was like this early Zen master, you know, before, you know, and he was not a spiritual guy, but he was just all in and present to where he was. So when we were with him, he wanted to document everything. And he was like, you know, I ran my first race when I was 7, and I tell the story in Running Home, which is one of my favorites, sort of the origin story of becoming a runner. But I crossed the finish line in just a total mess. You know, I just run 6 miles. I was 7 years old. Like, you know, it was not a pretty sight, but my dad, you know, was there to document the finish. And then he wanted me to go back and crawl across the finish line and sort of stage this goofy photo. So he was just always right there, which is ironic because we didn't live with him, you know, and he was very geographically distant from us, but emotionally really present. And and then when we were gone, he was doing his life without us. But he also, we had these incredible phone conversations. You know, he was a great conversationalist, and he was the person in my life who wanted to know all the details, and not so that he could brag on me or be like, you know, parents do now, and I'm one of them, but like, you know, my kid got all A's, but he was just curious. So he taught me how to be curious in the world.
How did he do that when the communication was, let's say, every 3 weeks?
Yeah, well, we talked every week on the phone. Okay. You know, he would call us from his party line. Remember those where it was like you shared the line with your farm neighbors? He would call us from the party line at his farm, or more often from his office at Nat Geo. And we would have these great conversations every Thursday. And so he stayed, you know, we stayed in touch that way. He was an amazing letter writer.
Keeps getting richer. All right. So tell me about those conversations.
You know, as a kid, it was probably, I don't always remember them, but, it was like, you know, he wanted to know what was going on in school or the sports and, you know, like how was my schoolwork and what projects was I working on? And, you know, I probably told him a little bit about my life at home in New Jersey, but that's complicated. There was not a lot of crossover, right? And you asked me about the emotions that this sort of brought up for me as a child. And what I can really remember is the feeling of I had to be very cautious around both my parents so that if I was talking too much about the other, that I might be disloyal to that one, if that makes sense. So yeah,
triangulation. It's a classic experience for kids in contentious environments.
So school was a super safe subject, talked about school a lot. I loved school. I was a huge reader. I still am. But, you know, we talk about books. We would talk about music as I got older. He was a huge music lover. He played many instruments. He was a great listener. You know, he had a huge record collection. So those were areas that were safe. And then as I got older and went to college and was more, you know, became much more of an outdoor athlete and adventurer, we talked about adventures. And so all of those things we went deep on. It was just that I had this sense of guilt. And I think that's very normal as a young child, right? The divorce couldn't possibly have been my fault. But as a young child, you feel that it somehow must have been. And so I had these very latent feelings of guilt and really strong shame that I had done something. And so I had to be careful. I couldn't talk about really my home life in New Jersey with my mother and stepfather because I felt somehow that I was being disloyal. My father never said that, and I'm sure he wouldn't have felt unhappy if I'd talked about it. It was just this rule that I had made somehow in my, you know, six-year-old's brain. Sort of sad,
It is. I mean, I can give you the psychological reasoning why that we think that happens. You know, it's part of brain development. You know, the formation experience is like the world revolved around you.
Of course.
And
right.
So if it revolved around you, then you're the epicenter of impact in the entire universe. And so when you see the two people that are supposed to take care of you not be able to get along, it must be because you're a pain in the ass or you've made a mistake or something. But it, you know, obviously it's, as an adult, we can say it's not the case. Did your dad?
But that lives in you for a long time.
That's,
I mean,
that's what I want to understand. Like,
so deep in me.
Did you take that to drugs and alcohol?
No, gosh, okay, no, so never did drugs. I was such a goody two shoes. My parents, my mother and stepfather, the house I grew up in, it was like they were completely that just say no generation.
Yeah, you took the angel approach.
Yeah, I took be good, be really good, do everything well.
So the do good, right? Mm-hmm. So there's only a handful of emblems that people take on through crises as young kids, right? Yeah. The rebel, the jokester, the angel, you know?
Yeah.
And so you took on that performer angel thing. And oftentimes that can get confusing, right? Because it's like, I have to be perfect or I have to show a certain way so that, because if I don't, maybe people go away again, right? Some sort of internal dialogue. And so what has been, looking back now, what has been that the cost of that approach?
It's interesting. It's sort of a hybrid approach. I don't know, you know, you would obviously, you're the expert on this, but like I never really was the perfectionist because I knew I was too aware of my own shortcomings. And there was just whole areas where I'm not even gonna, you know, like there's no way I can be a perfectionist in this because, you know, that's not my area of strength. So I wouldn't define myself as a perfectionist. And the angel, that was sort of like, I don't know. I had a little bit of the rebel in me too, of like, I wanted to be a little different. I wanted to do well at things, but also stand a little outside. And maybe that was a sort of a defense mechanism, right? That I wasn't the total overachiever. I mean, I wanted to do well in everything, but my sister, who was older than me, is amazing. And she, when I, you know, being her younger sister, there was no way I was going to be the best at anything because she came first and she was, you know, everyone said she looked like Princess Di. She was a straight A student. You know, she was 6 feet tall and ran track and cross country. So I had this sort of benefit a little bit of being in her shadow. So I could kind of have a little bit rebellion. But I was never the bad girl. It was just, I like to differentiate myself. I think that's what it was. I like to be a little separate.
Wow. Okay. There you go. Were you lonely?
No, I don't remember feeling lonely. I had lots of friends. I was always at, you know, very comfortable in the world and in groups. I wasn't lonely. I really missed my father, but I didn't have words to put that to, because certainly with my mother and stepfather, we didn't talk about my dad and we didn't talk about his life on the farm with my stepmother. And so I felt lonely for him without being able to really express it. And I felt a little lonely in my sisterhood because my sister was a very serious reader. If I was a reader, she was like to the nth degree a reader. And she was also from a very young age a writer. And I write about this in my book, but she had a typewriter. And she was writing a trilogy when she was like 9 years old. And so I would always knock on the door because I was such a physical kid and I wanted to be outside playing. And I would knock on her door and say, Meg, come and play with me. And she'd open it a crack, you know, you could hear the typewriter keys going thwack, thwack. And then she'd open the door and be like, I'm writing, and slam it. And so, I was a little lonely, but, I felt in a way, even with that shame and guilt that was sort of way deep down, I felt an ease in the world.
Wow. Awesome. I mean, if I wouldn't ask those early questions, I might've assumed because of your desire to do ultra, you know, the 50 milers and 100 milers, that you might've been using running as your obsession, right? Like maybe an escape mechanism, but I'm not sure that that fits for you. And maybe I don't want to presuppose anything here, but like ultras are different. People that do ultras are different. You know, it's as you would recognize, an incredible amount of time and deep pain and discomfort that comes with it. So,
but also great euphoria and sort of transcendence
and insight and
and observation. And so it's both and, I don't know that I would say that I do use it as an obsession or escape. Everyone loves to say that, well, what are you running from? Certain days I am running from the dishes in the sink or the laundry or a deadline, know, but I think in the much larger scheme of things, I've always been running towards something, which is kind of my true self and my essence and, my expression as a human being. And, so I think from an early age, I recognized that being outside in motion was a way to feel closer to that, my true self, and kind of who I am below all the external, variables and circumstances.
Okay. I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside, but when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. You've done work on yourself. It's evident to me that you have. And I know that you've got an appreciation for Zen traditions.
Yes.
And so the reason I like where we started is because we're like triple clicking and pulling on that thread about like what was sitting inside of you early, mm-hmm. that was the formative experiences for you to go search, you know, like what you're really searching for in life. And in the Zen traditions, like there's always a duality and a riddle mm-hmm. in life. And the idea from a Buddhist tradition that you're actually searching and craving for something is at the seed of suffering for many. So I mm-hmm. say that with I'm going to ask this question with both of those philosophies underneath the surface here. And then also like the Christian influence is like, it all answers this question in a very different way. But the question that I want to ask is like, what are you searching for?
That's such a great question. I don't know. The first hit I got when you were just sort of introing that question was that I'm searching for connection.
Let's pause right there. I want to know how you work more so than the answer sometimes, mm-hmm. but I want to know when you said first hit, how did that work for you?
Yeah. You just said, what are you searching for? And just, it came up from within me, from sort of deep in my belly, almost like this feeling of, I want connection.
Okay. Wait, so hold on. So let me keep pulling. It was a feeling.
Yeah. It's a feeling.
Okay. And then you put words on it that this mm-hmm. feeling is, but what was the feeling?
Oh, kind of like literally the feeling was sort of this warmth, this kind of expansive warmth. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I don't know what it was like inside of your body, right? So yes, that's what I'm, but metaphorically, yes, like not metaphorically, like concretely, yes. So it's a warmth and an expansion. And when you feel warmth and expansion, you label that says, oh, this must be this connection that I'm mm-hmm. looking for.
Yeah.
So it comes from I don't want to label this, but there's a safety. There's a, like I'm re-saying warmth, but it's not scratchy. It's not,
it's not
small,
sticky.
Isolated. It, you know, like that's the duality of things. We can come from lots of different angles, but it sounds like warmth and space. Oh, that feels like love. That feels like connection. Yeah. That's really what I'm searching. Is that, am I putting words in your mouth, or is that?
No, I mean, that's really, I think absolutely what the feeling is, and is that desire to feel connected, not only to myself and sort of my, you know, true nature, but the natural world, my parents, humanity, humans, like, you know, who once existed, who will exist. If we're talking in the Zen, you know, from a Zen perspective, it's sort of all sentient beings, you know, now and in the past and to come, you know. And I feel when I run, you know, especially in the last several years, as my running practice has deepened, that's what I'm really running for and toward.
And then how does that search, that desire to be connected, how does that map to your early experiences? And then how does that map to what life later could look like if this thing like really worked out favorably to your, you know, your wild imagination that you have? You
know, I will, like, be a Zen master.
No. Is that it though? Is that what you're, have you ever said that out loud?
No, I just said it out loud.
Just now.
Just now.
Yeah.
I thought about it the other day when I was writing to my friend Natalie, who I write about in Running Home. She's a dear friend. Natalie Goldberg is a student of Zen, but this incredible writing teacher and, you know, world famous author. And she's kind of become my friend, not kind of, she is my friend. And I write about our friendship in the book. She's been away in Japan, and we have been out of touch for a few weeks, and I was just texting her, and the words, "Nat, I've found the true path now," came to mind. And that's what I wrote to her. Like, I'm going down the path now, the real path. And I didn't know what that meant when I said it, but I also did know that that is a deepening of my Zen practice, and running is an expression of that, and a way, to sort of, you know, is my form of practice. But I kind of think that's where I'm going, and I haven't said it out loud. I hope that doesn't sound presumptuous.
No, I felt it. Like when you said it, I was like, oh, this is new. You know, this is a cool space. Okay. And then I want to tell you a story before we go to like how it mapped in the past, but I was, this was probably about 12 years ago now. I was fortunate enough to do some really fun work with Nike at, they had a board, an advisory board that they spun up, and it was called the Global Advisory Board of Human Performance. And it was about 16 of us, and it was all across the planet. It was incredible. And it was super stimulating, very much, a big part of my growth arc because of the humans that were in that room and the depth of knowledge and the science and the crispness and the ideation. And it had very little to actually do with Nike at that point. It was really about these beautiful humans that were smart and wanted to do, reimagine the human experience. And it was awesome. Okay. So it's a long way of saying it circulates some ideas. And I was like, oh. And I walked away super stimulated. And then I came back to Nike and I pitched an idea to, a board member and certainly an executive of the company. And at the end, this very wise woman from Nike looked at me, and it was kind of a hallway conversation. And she said, she looked, I'll never forget the feeling, and I'm having a hard time articulating, but she looked right in me as this wise sage woman from Nike would have. And she'd been around the block for sure in the business world. And she looked at me, she said, "Good luck with that." And it was said in a way that was like, "I see what you see, and that ain't going to be easy, kid." You know, and kid, 12 years old, but she was much older than me. And so I had, when you were telling that story, and sorry for the long narrative here, but I wanted to say to you, like,
good luck,
you know, like, and I mean it from that warmth and open space, like, that's awesome, you know?
Yeah.
And oh boy, you know, like the riddle of life and is that it's, It becomes simple with wisdom, but I'm not there. And it's not as simple as like, I just want to get on the path. And it is as simple as I'm on the path.
I'm on the path.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it takes a long time of being on the path to know that, to all of a sudden have that moment where you're like, oh, I'm on the path. And the path's going to change. And there's going to be a ton of detours. And it's going to be really crooked. And there's going to be dead ends. But it, and it's not fast, right? That's what I've learned. But
the goal,
yeah,
is the goal is the path.
The path is the thing.
Yeah.
The path. Yeah.
It's okay. So then let's get out of the esoteric. Like, the goal is the path. The path is the thing. For you, what is the path?
Well, the path is running and writing and understanding my connection, you know, in the world and Zen, I think really is the path, and those three things together, the running, the writing and Zen are the path. And, I can't really articulate, well, if we're talking about the path, we don't need to talk about the outcome, right? Because there, you know, if you're trying to get there, right, there's no there, you're just on the path and you get to where you're going and you realize you're still going.
I had a fun conversation on a podcast, earlier today. And the conversation that I was asked was like, okay, I don't think I can do more than two things mm-hmm. at once, you know, like being a great parent and being a business person. And mm-hmm. Tina was her name. And so Tina says, and it was a fun conversation, Tina Muir, she's a runner as well. Mm. And she said, I'm not sure I can do more than two things. And I thought, wait, hold on. And it maps onto what you and I are talking about, Katie, is that no, it's the path. It's not like right. the outcome of like, how many things can I do? But when the principles are right and the path is right and that stuff is lined up, anything and everything we do is maximized.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you said that, my first thought was that running and writing and mothering, if that's my other big hat that I wear, are when they're all working together, it is like this really powerful positive feedback loop.
Did you just pull back the word perfect?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I might have, not consciously, but powerful. Yeah, because it's not always perfect and they don't always fire together. But when they are firing together, you know, running helps me become a better writer and a better mother. And mothering gives depth and perspective to my running and my writing. And yeah, so they all inform each other and they converge. It can be this very profound convergence of those parts of my life that come together. And that's happened several times, you know, specifically at Leadville last summer when I won that race in my
How
first
bad. Okay, hold on. Before I you know, get in, like,
yeah, we don't have to go there yet.
No, let's go there now. But tell people what Leadville is. Like, it is... It's the heavy of the heavies, you know?
Yeah. So the Leadville 100 trail run is a 100-mile ultra marathon in the mountains of Colorado, kind of legendary race made famous in part by Chris McDougall and his book Born to Run. But it's just, you know, it's sort of the grandfather of big mountain ultras. And yeah, it was my first 100. I had what you would call beginner's mind, which is a completely powerful tool to use and has become really a big part of my run training is to try to stay in that beginner's mind. But it really was my first 100.
But this 100 is interesting because it's goat trailed and it is it's an elevation. So this isn't like running 100 miles across, I don't know, a 64 degree flatland, you know, with zero elevation. Like, this is something that is,
it has a lot of topography and mm-hmm. yes, high elevation. I think the high point is 12,600 feet, which not coincidentally is the high point that I can run to out my door. So it was, I was really suited to run Leadville. It was the terrain that I run here in my home hills. Is in Santa Fe, which many people think is like Phoenix, you know, but we are at the southern end of the Rocky Mountains. We're a high desert community and we have, you know, mountains up to 12,600 out the door. So it was like I was home at Leadville. And I felt that as soon as I got there, which is hard to explain.
Did you have a goal? Like, were you in a concrete place? Like, I'm going to go win this thing?
No,
Was it more like, I'm going to go run for fun, or
my
somewhere
goal
between?
Was to finish. My goal was to finish. And there was a complicated story leading up to Leadville, which is that I had broken my leg in a fairly traumatic wilderness accident 2 years earlier. And I was on, my husband and I do a lot of whitewater river trips. Rivers are really important to me and sort of in my approach to flow and being in nature. And so anyway, we do a lot of river trips, but we were on the Middle Fork of the Salmon, which is a remote wilderness river in Idaho. And on the first day, you know, maybe an hour from when we put on the river, we flipped our raft in a fluke accident, and I fell out of the raft, and the impact or the torque of falling, interestingly enough, I resisted the fall. I remember like not wanting to fall. And I think that's what did it, but I broke my tibial plateau, just below my knee. And, so long story short, we stayed on the river. We would have had to call a medical evac. And I didn't think, I have very high pain tolerance, obviously, but I didn't think it was broken, or I hoped it wasn't. And so we stayed on the river for 6 days, which was super intense and kind of its own, you know, surreal Zen experience. But when I got back to Santa Fe, I went to the doctor and he's like, you broke your tibial plateau and you need surgery. And when I went to meet the surgeon, you know, he was very cut and dry. And he just said, if I were you, I would never run again. So all of which is to say that when I showed up in Leadville in August of 2018 to run my first 100, I was just so grateful to have been able to do the training and arrive at the starting line healthy, and to do something that I'd never imagined myself able to do after breaking my leg, that I knew that everything that followed at the race was just going to be a celebration of the fact that I was there. And so my mindset was completely one of gratitude and openness to the experience. And I think that's why I was able to do so well.
Yeah. I mean, the gifts of struggle to get us to the places where we can let go, you know, cause we have, I don't know, it's children, young children are able to let go and trust because it's just kind of how things work for them. And then as we get older and we get burned and we go through some tougher times and challenges, sometimes we want to hold on more, but it sounds like you were able to go through that suffer struggle and get to the other place to say, you know what, I'm stoked to be here. And I'm going to add something, which is, let me just do my best.
It was a real feeling. I was very overwhelmed when I drove into Leadville, and the mountains rise up to the west of the road on the way in. And I had to pull over, you know, and stop my car because I just felt so emotionally overwhelmed by the path I'd been on and the journey and the twists and turns and those awful, you know, months when I was, you know, on crutches and really taken down to zero and not sure if I could run again. And so, it was one of the strongest feelings I've ever had. And, I think just to your point about letting go and trusting, that is something that ultra running has taught me. And I began to sort of cultivate that well before Leadville, kind of from my first ultra in 2012, was that feeling of, I knew that if I showed up at the starting line, having done the work, and I didn't know this the first time, but it worked the first time I had put in my training and I showed up. And it's like I switch a button in my head or switch, you know, to receive mode. And I just go into it like, okay, I've done the work. Now I'm open to whatever's going to happen. Show me, you know, I almost say that to the run or the race, like, okay, show me, teach me, what is this about? And so right from the beginning of running ultras, I had that trust. You have to let go because an ultra, it's such a great metaphor for life, but there's so many variables and so many factors you can't predict. You know, in one race, it's not like road running where, you know, the same distance is the same race. You know, if you run a marathon in this city, it's the same in that one. You know, there's terrain, there's elevation, there's weather, there's, you know, the technical trails. And so you really have to let go of any preconceived notion and sort of open to what will be.
What a cool insight. Like, show me.
Show me. Mm. That's really like, and I don't know where that came from. That was just right away early on. And I just, you know, I felt literally like I was flipping a switch to receive, like, okay, I'm in receive mode.
I mean, a really novel way. I've never heard anyone say it before, but to activate like that beginner's student mind, right? Like, that's really cool.
And like, so, anything's possible, the good things and the bad things, you know. You could be in top shape and you can go into a race, you know, in peak form, and all possibilities exist, the good ones and the hard ones.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real-world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO. apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Why race though? Because the path is somehow for you is interested in the testing against maybe other people. I don't know, but why? What is it about the many events that you go to and the competitions that you're at that is stimulating for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a complicated relationship with competition and racing. It's it's really a very, you know, the tippiest tippy top of the iceberg of why I run. And so I think for me, the races are structure. So they create the structure around which I can organize. And it's not just goal setting, like I'm going to set this goal and get there. But it's kind of a bigger, it's bigger than that, but it's something to work toward and to apply what I'm learning about myself and my practice of running in a concrete way. It's also a little bit about accountability. I don't have any trouble motivating to run and to do big runs and adventure runs, you know, that's not it. But if I can organize around a big objective, you know, say a race, it gives some shape to my days and my path that then allows me to have freedom in it. So, you know, if I'm organizing around a structure, say the Leadville 100, then I know that's off on the horizon. Then I can be really hyper present to my days and my runs that lead me there. Same thing with writing a book. I knew I have the book deadline out there, you know, but then that allows me, it frees me to be very present in my writing that day. Like I'm working on this chapter or this, you know, this paragraph. And I think the other big part about racing is that community and being connected. Because I do most of my runs by myself. And I think that's just part of being a writer runner, you know, and it's a creative thing for me. So I do a lot of creative thinking when I'm running, and I like to run alone. But then at races, you can really be part of something bigger.
Okay, this is amazing insights and journey that you have, and I'm really enjoying this. How do you get in your? Yeah, thanks. And I mean that. How do you get in your way? How do you get in your own way?
How easily? Oh, the voices in our head, you know, in my head. We all have them, but it's the self-doubt.
What specifically does it sound like for you?
Oh, it has so many different voices, but I'll give you an example, like with ultra running. Oh, you're not the real deal. Like, you know, you're old. You're not the real deal. You haven't run enough ultras to really be serious. You don't know what you're doing. As a writer, this is the best one that came, you know, not the best one, the worst one, but I faced it almost every day that I was writing my book was like, everyone, you know, has written this kind of book and you're, you know, people have done it much better than you. Like, who cares? That kind of voice.
I love it.
So sad. I mean, we spend so much energy listening to those voices, you know. The other way I get in my knee is, you know, the doctor was right. You shouldn't be running. You know, he's going to have the last laugh. I mean, that doctor lived in my knee for at least a year after my surgery. And finally, I just had a day where I realized like, wait, that was his story about not running, but that does not have to be mine. And I could, you know, I could write my own story around running.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Like, and that apt metaphor for every part of life. Who knows you better than you?
Right.
Others, if you don't do the work to know you. But by limitation, they're putting their frame on you. So our responsibility as adults, you know, young adults, right, is to explore and understand the truth and discover, who am I? It's the most ancient of meditations. Who am I?
Who am I? And that's where that intuitive or intuition is so important. And what I've really learned to trust and to listen to, because that's the voice to listen to, not the voice saying like, no, you're slow, you're old, people have written the same book, you know, but that voice inside that doesn't even make sense all the time. That was sort of my intuition that said earlier in our conversation, like, I'm going to be a Zen master. I don't, you know, like, that was not a conscious thought. That was something deeper within me. And, you know, the voice is hard to hear sometimes because there's so much noise in the world. And, you know, there's noise of our screens and, you know, and the news and our social media feeds. And, but if we can get quiet, that voice is in all of us, and it's really, it will lead us where we're meant to go.
What do you do when you have that other voice, which is like, you know, the critic voice, which is
Katie, you're too much. Yeah.
In that moment that you have that thought, what do you do? But I also want to know, how long do you entertain that train of thought? How many stops does it take before you're
too
aware?
Too long. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, sometimes like months, right? And that's sort of, you know, I think my first experience with that in a really, you know, understanding or being able to see how strong it was in me, that voice, was after my father died. And my grief manifested as anxiety that I was dying too. And boy, that was like a year of listening to that voice straight through and believing the voice.
That's a long time.
I had this intense health anxiety that could hear that someone had X disease and then I would develop it. And I was sure I had it. And I didn't come out of that for at least a year or 18 months.
So a true syndrome disorder. Like this wasn't just a light, you know, like, oh, I was just kind of worried. This was like, you really struggled.
It really got me and it had me in its clutches. And what it really was, as far as I can understand it now, was my grief. But I didn't know how to just be in that emotion of sadness, having lost my father, who on so many levels was so important and dear to me and influential in my life. I had to make up stories around it. So the story I made up was that I was sick and I was dying. If he died, I was going to die. And it was also partly, aggravated by the fact that I had just given birth to my second daughter. So I had some postpartum, some sort of new mother anxiety. Anyway, it was this intense mashup where I was sure I was dying. And my body told the completely opposite story. I was able to run, 20 miles, 30 miles. So on one level, I knew I was healthy, but I was listening to that voice that was like, nope, you must be dying. And so that voice had me for a long time. And now that I understand that voice, and the voice obviously has different messages. Some days it's about my writing, some about my running, a lot about my mothering, but I'm hip to the voice. So it doesn't hold me as long. It doesn't grab me for as long. But also there's vulnerable times, like different times of the year. You know, I'm definitely affected by day length and season, and, you know, around the anniversary of my dad's death, which is right now, this time of year, I'm more vulnerable. So in those vulnerable times, you know, I can get hooked more easily.
Mm, very cool. What are some of the habits that you have in your life that are cornerstone habits for you? Maybe there's, two, three, four habits that are part of your daily rhythm.
Yeah, I love that. Movement, is the first thing. Being outside. So being out in nature, fresh air, even if it's just walking my kids to school, walking with them, feeling the sun on my face and literally feeling that vitamin D absorbing helps my spirit. Movement is my number one thing. So just being a body in motion. And most of the time that expresses itself as running, but I love to ride my bike and just cruise around. I'm that person you see just riding around the neighborhood, feeling like I'm 8 years old, and not for fitness, but just being in motion. When I move my body, I move my mind and I move that imagination. And that is integral to how I write and how I do my work as a journalist and a writer. So being outside, being in motion, writing for sure. So I keep notebooks, which other people I guess would call journals, but I prefer notebooks have this more utilitarian feeling to them. They don't feel quite as precious. And that allows me just to write whatever I want in them and to not feel that I have to write anything special or good. And that's something, just circling back to my father, when you know, that he did teach me. And again, not really by, maybe he said it a few times, but mostly I just watched him. He kept notebooks all the time, the little spiral notebooks he'd shove in his back pocket. He'd write down things that he thought of. He kept insane track of his gas mileage and within this little notebook that sat in his glove box that was probably, he probably had like 50 notebooks over the years keeping track. But he just recorded things. And I developed early on that as my habit, my practice, was to keep notebooks. And now I write, I probably go through a notebook a month And a lot of it is like, if I'm working on something in my writing, but I don't want it to feel formal, like that has to be good, I'll write it in my notebook. And actually that's really how I understood that I was writing this book, because I was writing in my notebooks all through my dad's illness and after he died and my anxiety. And it was only maybe 2 or 3 years after he died that I had enough distance, literal distance on his death, and perspective, literal perspective from like running up mountains and standing up there and looking down, that I understood all of a sudden that all that writing, I'd been writing my book, you know, in my books.
Do you have a meditation practice?
I do have a meditation practice. So sitting would be my other big habit. So if it's movement and nature and writing, the other one is sitting. And I joke about this, that I'm, you know, I have far greater stamina for running than I do for sitting. But I try to sit about 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes every day. And often that's outside. I like to combine my habits. So one of my favorite things that I've been doing this fall is I'll ride my bike with my kids to school, and then I'll take the long way home up along the river trail. So I'm riding, I'm out in nature, and then I get to the river and I'll sit for 15 minutes. And then I ride home, and then I'm in that, I've really set myself up for my running and writing day, you know, for my writing and, for whatever running I'm doing.
Is there a form to your meditation?
A form? Like, do I focus on my breath?
Yeah. Do you have any structure to it?
You know, I sit in the same position, so I'll sit cross-legged, or if I'm at home, I sit on my meditation cushion. And I would say I mostly just key in on my breath. I don't count my breath. I sometimes will use sound as an anchor, you know, so if I'm sitting by the river, I'll use the river. But it's pretty simple breathing. I don't listen to any apps or guided meditation, not because I think, you know, I'm a very skilled practitioner, but because the voice, you know, distracts me, and I kind of find that I want the quiet. And I certainly have all the thoughts, right, going through my brain. And some days my mind is so busy, but I'll just catch myself thinking, and I'll just either just say thinking, or I will come back to my breath. Sometimes I do sit with an idea. So like if I'm sitting beside the river, I'll think about how the river is, you know, itself has no obstructions, but the things in the river, the rocks and the leaf clumps, are the obstructions. So I'll sit with an idea, but I won't think about it. I'll just sort of absorb the idea.
Eyes open or eyes closed for you?
Usually closed, because otherwise I find myself drifting into like, oh, look at this pretty tree or something. But it's not strict. I don't have a strict form, but I sort of just toggle between these different ways that works. And the main thing that has helped me is to realize that it's not about emptying your mind of thoughts, right? Like the thoughts are going to be there, but just, it helps me to think about like, okay, they're coming, and let them see them, but then let them pass like clouds, right? So a cloud will come over and then it just goes by and you don't grip onto it. And that's really helped me with my sort of that voice in my head, right? Like, you again, you're the naysayer voice or the anxiety voice. I see you, but I'm not going to get caught by you.
You know, so mindfulness training takes many forms, you know, the ancient tradition forms to something that people are inventing on their own. Right. And so, I've been enamored with the tradition and the process for the past 20 some years. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you've got a blend between like a single point focus and something more contemplative as well. And you probably, not structured, you just kind of go back and forth and kind of sort it out. But I want to tell you a funny story. There was a world-class athlete I was working with, and she was struggling with like her inner critic. Mm-hmm. And she was at the beginning days of her meditation practice. And so she says, she goes, I figured it out. And she's super animated. Yeah. It was like, and I was like, really? And
she says, I love that.
Yeah. And she goes, yeah. She goes, let me explain it to you. And I said, okay. She says, I've got a shit bird. This is how it works for me. I go, what is that? And she says, no, there's this little bird that's been on my shoulder my whole life, and it just shits all over me. And I said, and so I got these big eyes, and I'm like, this is genius, right? And she says, so now I'm just shooing the shit bird off my shoulder. That's what meditation is. I'm just shooing, and I'm just like not angry about it. I'm like, I see you, and yeah, I'm shooing off my shoulder. And she says, now I see that it's sitting in the tree, and it wants to land on my shoulder. And I just watch it land sometimes, and I just kind of adjust my shoulder. I go, this is great. She goes, you know what's happening though? This is over time. Like this is I'm giving you a condensed conversation of many months. She says, the shit bird's not around as much. I look in trees for it, and it's just not there. And so isn't that a cool, like fun way to think about, I don't know, just the inner narrative.
I love that.
Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. So it's a fun insight, you know,
I think what I've learned too, is just not to resist. Mm-hmm. So whatever is happening, just meet that moment. And it could be that you're sitting, and this is like, I find sitting has become more relaxed for me because whatever arises, and if it's I have busy brain, and if I have the shit bird shitting all over me, whatever it is, I just meet it head on, right? Like my friend Natalie has this saying, inhabit your life moment by moment. So I'm just inhabiting that moment. And it helps me not resist what's happening and not get critical about my sitting practice or, you know, but just to sit.
Yeah, I love it. This is awesome. Okay. So what are the main influences of thought in your life? It sounds like dad was one. It sounds like Zen traditions is another. And then like, who is that in the Zen traditions? It's not like there's one book.
You know, well, there is kind of, no, there's, of course there's not one book, but I think that Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, become a total Bible for me. And I got this not long after I'd broken my leg. And it's like the Golden Gate Bridge, like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, you know, they say like, as soon as they finish, they have to start over painting it because it takes so long. And, you know, like by the time they're done, it's time to start over again. But that's really how I've been reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Like, I'll just get to the end and I'll start over. And so that's been really influential to me, sort of having that beginner's mind in my writing and in my running and even in my parenting and kind of just being a partner to my husband. So that's been really formative. But I will say also my mother has been a big influence in that she's sort of that incredibly bright, optimistic person. And in as much as my father's kind of curiosity and contemplation and observation and creativity rubbed off on me, her optimism and just general joy and belief that everything works out is so deep in me as well. So I'm really a blend of both my parents. And I feel it's funny because I am such an optimist and I think, well, how can I be so anxious if I'm an optimist? But the two are not mutually exclusive, right? I think deep down, I absolutely believe that everything works out and carries you to the next place. But I get that sort of, you know, worry brain, you know, the chatter, the noise in between, but it doesn't sway me from the path ultimately that is, you know, we're going where we're meant to go and it's going to work out.
Cool. Have you read Alan Watts stuff?
No.
Oh yeah. Check out Alan Watts. It's a kind of a classic as well. I think you might feel refreshed. You know, the way of Zen is a really, it's a classic. And Tao Te Ching. Are you spending any time?
Yes. Yeah. I got that recently and I had read it a long time ago and,
read it with somebody.
I don't know. It felt very simplistic.
No, I think it's too complicated. Like read it with somebody that can appreciate the depth of it. It's like, it's a mind boggler.
I think my other big thing that I've been really reading lately is Dogen. and that just sort of goes back to the source and is sort of Zen in its, and, you know, most fundamental form. And earlier this fall, when I was in this really in sort of intense training block, I would run up in the mountains, long once a week, like 20 to 25 miles, you know, above 10,000 feet on these long solo missions. And I would have read Dogen, some passage beforehand, and none of this was premeditated. I wasn't like, I'm going to go read Dogen and then go run on him. But like, I would do that. But then I would carry what I'd read with me into the mountains and sort of have this transcendent, you know, understanding of his words as I ran. And that was a pretty profound experience.
You know, when you're talking, I'm thinking about like the more challenging conditions for humanity, and it's like chronic stress, sleep, this mythical ridgeline of balance, purpose, you know, like those are some of the big challenges, connection for and connection, I should say, for humanity. Can you talk about purpose for a minute and your purpose and what, can you riff on that for a little bit?
Purpose. Yeah. So what comes to mind is, expression, for me is probably my greatest purpose. And that's like true expression. And so that can come through my writing, like to express the truth of something. And I don't just mean the facts of something, obviously, though I hope that I'm factually accurate, but the essence, to express something that possibly many people have experienced, but I'm expressing it in the way I can. And I think that goes to parenthood too, is to help my daughters find their expression. And running is a form of expression, absolutely, 100% for me. And so I don't know if that's concrete enough, but it feels that expression is my purpose, and to express something that maybe other people feel but can't express or don't have the words for. And certainly that's what I've heard about my book, is that people, I've been getting these incredible letters from readers all over who say, like, that's exactly how I felt, and I've never been able to put words to it. Mm.
I think our artistic expression is one of the higher forms of the human experience. And, you know, to be able to do that under duress, or exact or dissolve duress, and to be able to artistically express in every and all environments is what self-mastery looks like to me. And so, very cool. Are you more interested in mastery of craft or self?
Oh, I don't know if there's a difference.
Yeah, I think there is. I think craft is like the exact of the foot strike, you know, for let's say a runner. You know,
I'm not a very low tech. I'm not into all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't need. Yeah. I'm definitely more into mastery of self, like the craft. If it's serving mastery of self, then I'm interested in that. But I'm not the runner who wants to, you know every aspect of training or, that kind of thing. I'm into the feel of it, sort of how it feels to be in that state, less like, you know, less the technicalities of it.
So I've done some initial research of the 200 podcasts that we've had, and we're coming back with some insights around purpose and that values are really important to people exploring mastery. What are the handful of values that matter most to you? If you would agree with, you know, values being important.
Definitely. I agree with values. I worked with a coach, a life coach maybe 15 years ago, when I was starting to think about leaving my job at Outside. And I had been a writer and managing editor there for many years, and it was so wrapped up in my identity, but I knew that I wanted to do my own writing and in my own voice. And the intuition was very strong, but I had a lot of, you know, my ego was wrapped up in my job, and, you know, I had to untangle all of that. But when I was working with my life coach, we worked on values. And so, they've been guiding values in my life, and they're so helpful to use when you have to make decisions, because it's just very clear, like, does that serve one of my values? No, then the answer is no. So my main values are adventure, which includes, you know, endurance and running and being outside, but adventure, family/community. So being connected to our home place, and my home now includes my children, and expression. So that's the creative expression and the writing. So they're quite broad. I mean, it's interesting that I didn't say you know, running or endurance. You know, it was adventure. It's a bigger umbrella that encapsulates our love of rivers and backcountry and traveling outside with our kids and taking our kids into wilderness. But it also includes my serious pursuit of ultra running and endurance.
What? Like, it makes sense. It really makes sense to me.
Oh, yeah. Good. I'm glad.
Yeah. This is so, like, I mean, I understand.
Values are so good. Yeah. To get clear on your values that, because I can be, it's, you know, like anyone, and anxiety is part of this. Anxiety creates indecision and some, you know, not being clear, lack of clarity, but coming back to those values always, you know, cuts through that uncertainty.
So let me take a quick pass at a couple principles and see if I'm close to this. I think that you are an extroverted thinker. You're mm-hmm. more of an introverted feeler. You're probably more extroverted in nature, by default, but I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. I feel like you probably are more go with the flow, mm-hmm. and you have this very intuitive way that you organize how information comes in. And I think that you're more street savvy than analytical, but I'm not sure.
Right? you're totally nailing it.
Yeah. And I would imagine that you would prefer a slow paced environment for learning than rather something rapid and fast. And I think you might be a risk taker, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm, definitely
a risk taker. You are a risk taker, right? Yeah. And I think you probably have a high need for control, and that's why you're attracted to the Zen to teach you how to let go. And that high need of control was probably born out of like not really knowing from an early age, like how much maybe you mattered, but getting the senses that you really did, but like that unsortedness probably mm-hmm. left with some control/anxiety stuff that, you know, has been mildly or intensely pervasive in periods. But I don't think you're like this intellectually competitive person where your ideas have to be right out front. It's like, I don't get that at all for you.
It's funny. People think like, you know, if you're successful or if you're driven to succeed and win, say in races, that you're a type A. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like I'm too disorganized. My interest in being in the flow and sort of going with what presents and sort of going where the energy is. I'm not super structured because I need room for spontaneity, but then I also, I do need some organizing structure. But for example, so a lot of the times how I decide what I'm running or training, you know, I'm very unconventional as an athlete, I think, because I resist having that mapped out plan, or maybe I'll have the plan, but then I decide each day what I'm going to run or where I'm going to run based on how I feel and like, where do I see myself running and where do I want to run that day? So I need room for spontaneity. And sometimes when I get too locked into things, I get, you know, I feel stifled and I rebel. I have a definite rebellious streak.
There we go. Okay. Favorite word right now? What are you vibing with? What's your word?
Oh my God. Favorite word. I don't know. I'm a writer, so I love all words.
Can't put you in a corner. Can't put you in a box. I respect.
My favorite word right now.
What is?
Flow.
Flow. There you go. Okay, cool.
Flow and like our energy does. And
yeah. I've really enjoyed this conversation. And like, how can folks that are stimulated by how you've organized your thinking structure in your life, like how can they find out more about you?
Okay. The first place is my website, katiearnold.net. And I'm on Instagram at Katie Arnold. I'm on Twitter at Raising Rippers. That's the name of a column that I started writing for Outside about bringing up kids outside, which is a passion of mine. But I write about all different things on Twitter. Facebook, I'm at Katie Arnold, author athlete. And also on my website, I'm starting to offer running and writing kind of flow retreats. I'm leading my first two this spring. I'm really excited. I've got one in Zion the last couple of days of February. I love symbolism and metaphor, but it's going to be over leap weekend, right? So leap day, which I think is such an exciting day. And it's such a good metaphor for making that leap in our lives. And so I've got one in Zion, and then I'm offering one here in Santa Fe in May. So you can find out all about that on my website.
Awesome. Thank you. And your book, where can,
yes,
you know,
my book Running Home is a memoir, and it's not just about running. Obviously, if you've listened to this, you get that vibe. And I just want to say one thing about the book. Running is sort of the through line through it, you know, but it's much more, it's a memoir about resilience and grief and kind of realizing we're so much stronger than we think. And so running is just my way through those things. But I really have told readers this, that like when I've been on book tour, that pretty much every time I say running, you could scratch that out and say your thing, and the message is the same, you know. So it's very much a book for non-runners, people who are interested in, you know, understanding what their path is and where they're headed. But you can buy that on Amazon. It's on Audible. I narrated the audiobook. You can get it as a Kindle edition. It's all available from Random House. And but also, I'm such a big reader and supporter of local bookstores. So please support your local bookstores. They're so integral to our communities. And if they don't carry Running Home, they'll be more than happy to order it for you.
That's what's up. Katie Arnold, I've loved this conversation.
It's been amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for spending your time and your insight with us.
Thank you for sharing all your insights. Great questions and just very thoughtful.
Awesome. Okay.
Awesome.
Look forward to next time with you.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
Take care.
Yeah. Bye.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.